Blog Talk Radio. Zabat Remy Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I'm your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Sunday, March 20th, 2022, the first day of spring in the United States. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to another edition of our program. Later on, we'll be coming up with our Pan-African Newswire report. We'll have dispatches on the announcement by the Russian government that a humanitarian corridor will be opening for residents of Mariupol in Ukraine. The economy of the Republic of Sudan has drastically declined amid demonstrations demanding an end to military rule. Cotton production in the West African state of Mali has reached record levels, according to the government. And Tanzania President Samia Suluhu Hassan has been in office for 1 year in the East African country. We'll have some reflections on that as well. Later in the program, we look at the continuing impact of Western sanctions against Zimbabwe. In the second and third hours, we continue our focus on Women's History Month with examinations of the lifetimes and contributions of Mary B. Talbert, the Phyllis Wheatley Society, and Miss Willie Mae Thornton. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. Stay tuned. We'll take our musical interlude with Letta Mbulu of the Republic of South Africa. This is an album released in 1970 entitled Letta.
touch me. You made me realize my lonely days were over. Baby, say we will be baby.
Oh,
Welcome back. And that was the great Leta Mbulu from South Africa, from the album entitled Leta. And right now we want to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment. Our lead story deals with the current war in Ukraine. According to various press agencies, humanitarian corridors from Mariupol will be open in the eastern and western directions from 10 in the morning tomorrow, Monday. Mikhail Misenstev, chief of Russia's National Defense Management Center, made this statement earlier today. According to Medzenzev, up to 130,000 civilians, including 184 foreigners from six countries, are still kept in the city as hostages. Taking this into account, Russia will be open humanitarian corridors from Mariupol in the eastern and western directions upon the agreement with the Ukrainian side from 10 a.m. Moscow time tomorrow on March 21st in order to save human lives and preserve Mariupol's infrastructure, and on the basis of intercepted radio talks of neo-Nazis who have realized the utter hopelessness of their position and senselessness of further resistance, he said, adding that Russian forces and units of the Donetsk People's Republic, the DPR, will declare a ceasefire and guarantee its observance from 9:30 a.m. Moscow time. He also said that Russian forces will give a possibility to nationalists to leave Mariupol unarmed via humanitarian corridors from 10 a.m. to noon Moscow time on March 21st. Ukrainian armed units and foreign mercenaries will be able to leave the city without weapons and munitions along a route agreed with Ukraine from 10 a.m. to noon Moscow time, he said, adding that from noon it is planned to let humanitarian convoys to reach the city. In his words, Mariupol residents will be free to choose a humanitarian corridor to leave the city. Each Mariupol resident and foreign nationals will be guaranteed voluntary choice of any of the humanitarian corridors or the right to stay in the unblocked city, he said. According to Medzinsev, each convoy will be escorted by mine engineers to clear mines in order to ensure safe evacuation of people. And in other news, on the African continent, Sudanese school teacher Babakar Mohamed barely covers his family's needs with his meager income, but since last year's military coup, he no longer knows if he can even keep afloat. Like many in Sudan, Mohamed has been grappling with shortages in basic goods, as well as new taxes and steep prices of fuel, electricity, and food since the October military coup led by Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. I used to buy 20 loaves of bread at 100 Sudanese pounds before the coup, Mohammed, who provides for a family of six, told the international press. Bread alone now costs me around 27,000 pounds a month, which is like 90% of my salary of about 30,000 pounds or 50 U.S. dollars, he said. Mohammed joined teachers who went on strike this week against the worsening living conditions. Sudan's latest coup upended a transition painstakingly negotiated between civilian and military leaders following the 2019 ouster of President Omar al-Bashir, whose rule was marked by crippling U.S. sanctions and international attempts at international isolation. It also triggered international condemnation and punitive measures with the United States, the World Bank, and the International Monetary Fund suspending aid and loans to the country. Sudanese exports have sharply declined. Foreign currency shortages have been reported, and efforts by local banks to reestablish ties with international counterparts in the United States and West and the West have come to a screeching halt. It's like the embargo was back since October the 25th, said The Economist, Sumaya Saeed. Protesters staged several rallies this week against the declining living conditions. Sudanese citizens have for decades endured severe economic hardship due to government mismanagement, internal conflict, and the 2011 secession of the oil-rich South. Bashir himself was ousted in April of 2019 following months of protests initially triggered by the tripling of bread prices. Hassanuddin Okasha, a spokesman for the Association of Bakery Owners in Khartoum, said bread prices have surged beyond people's reach. He attributed the hikes to increasing operational costs. Sudan is also especially vulnerable to the impact of global supply shortages in the wake of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Protesters in northern Sudan have in recent weeks blocked a key trade route between Egypt and Sudan following a sharp increase in electricity tariffs. In January, Sudanese authorities sharply raised electricity prices across sectors, with households seeing an increase of about 500%. Sudan had already embarked on plans to scrap fuel subsidies under the transition, which was derailed by the coup. Fuel prices have undergone several hikes over the past year. On Saturday, petrol at the pump cost 672 pounds, about $1.50 per liter, up from 320 pounds before the coup. Many local business owners have been forced to suspend operations. I have laid off some 300 employees, mostly women who were the breadwinners of their families, said a food factory owner in North Khartoum, speaking on condition of anonymity. I couldn't keep up with electricity and production input prices and hikes. Economist Mohamed Al-Nier says Sudan is in a state of shock. The absence of international aid and loans in the 2022 budget is having a negative effect, he said, pointing out that the fiscal plans rely heavily on tax rises. Taxes now constitute 52% of the budget, sharply increasing prices and pushing the country into a recession. Sudan has been reeling from triple-digit inflation, which stood at 258% just last month in February. It will not be possible for the government to bring down inflation. Instead, it will likely jump to 500%, forecast Nair. Sudan has yet to name a prime minister since the January resignation of UN economist-turned-premier Abdallah Hamdok. This month, Sudan formed a council to address key economic challenges led by the deputy head of his sovereign council, Mohamed Hamdan Daglo, known as Hameti. On March the 9th, Daglo blamed a mafia of currency dealers responsible for currency and gold speculation on the local market. Sudan's central bank announced this month it will allow the currency to float as part of measures to stem the market. It was the right decision, but at the wrong time, according to Saeed. She said the move would only drive up inflation and further weaken the local currency. In the middle of last month, the Sudanese pound hovered at 450 pounds to the dollar, but now the greenback buys at about 600 pounds. Central bank policies have so far failed, Saeed said. The situation requires proper reserves of funds and gold. You're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. In Mali, the president of the transition, Assimi Goïta, declared the record production on yesterday of figures that placed Mali as the top cotton producer on the African continent. According to the government, record production was made possible by maintaining a subsidy on agricultural inputs, maintaining a minimal shift in the cost of cotton seen among other initiatives. In September 2021, the United States Department of Agriculture had indicated in its report that Mali will be the largest cotton producer in Africa for the 2021-2022 season, followed by Benin, Cote d'Ivoire, and Burkina Faso. Mali planted a record 795,000 hectares, up 630,000 hectares. That's some 382% from last year's crop, the document noted. In addition, the U.S. report explained that Cote d'Ivoire also planted a record 460,000 hectares, while Benin and Burkina Faso added more than 600,000 hectares this year. At the end of the 2019-2020 season, Mali's cotton production totaled 700,000 tons, up 6.6% from 2018-2019. The volume harvested for the 2019-2020 campaign makes Mali, for the second consecutive year, the second largest producer of white gold in Africa behind Benin, 714,000 tons. Cotton producers boycotted the 2020-2021 cotton season following a misunderstanding with the authorities over the price of cotton seed set by the government. Finally, in 2018, Mali was ranked as a leading cotton producer on the African continent, with 725,000 tons of cotton seeds, according to data from the Malian Textile Development Company. And finally, in the North African state of Tunisia, there have been demonstrations against the government. Thousands of Tunisians rallied earlier today, the country's Independence Day, to protest against President Kais Saied and consultations over constitutional reforms proposed by him. Protesters shouted, "The people want to overthrow the president and no to consultations," according to the Agence France-Presse. The demonstrations were organized by the Islamist-inspired Ennahda Party and a movement named Citizens Against the Coup. And in the East African state of Tanzania, the president is affectionately known as Mama Samia to reflect the respect that people have in her. And according to a letter from African journalist Sammy Awami, who looks back at how Tanzania has changed in the years since Samia Suluhu Hassan became the country's first woman president following the death of President John Magufuli. "If a happiness index was taken within the last few weeks, it would have shown Tanzanians in the world," according to some Tanzanians on social media. Within the past few weeks, President Samia Suluhu Hassan, widely known as Mama Samia, met the two leading figures of the opposition party, Chadema, Tundu Lissu, and Freeman Mbowe, a meeting that would have been unimaginable just over a year ago. Mr. Lissu is living in exile after he was shot 16 times in 2017 in an assassination attempt widely believed to have been politically motivated. Mr. Mbowe has just been released from prison where he was held on terrorism charges since arrest last July ahead of a public rally to demand constitutional reform. And with that, we're going to conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment of our program. We'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service that is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998, and since then it has published thousands upon thousands of articles and dispatches in various newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of today, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And if you'd like to have access to today's Pan-African Journal, the special worldwide radio broadcast for Sunday, March 20th, 2022, just go to our website at the Pan-African Radio Network. And that's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. And right now we'll take a musical interlude, and we'll be back with more of our program for this week.
Save it.
Motown Sound, Detroit's own, via Inkster, a suburb of Detroit. That's the Marvelettes with the tune entitled Strange I Know. And right now we want to move into a segment focusing on the ongoing Western sanctions against the Republic of Zimbabwe and Southern Africa. These sanctions have been in effect for more than 2 decades. They were prompted in part by the land reform program of 2000, where the government of the Zimbabwe African National Union Patriotic Front redistributed millions of hectares of land which had been stolen more than a century before by the British settler colonialists. Let's listen to this report on sanctions in Zimbabwe and the struggle against them.
This is CGTN, China Global Television Network.
In a recent visit to Nairobi, Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa discussed a wide range of bilateral issues with his Kenyan counterpart Uhuru Kenyatta. Central to the visit, though, was Mnangagwa's petition for Kenyatta's help in Harare's battle against unilateral Western sanctions imposed in 2002 and scaled up in 2003. Zimbabwe says the sanctions have destroyed the livelihoods of its citizens and wants the embargo lifted. But are sanctions to blame for Zimbabwe's economic woes? This week on the program, we find out why they were imposed and their impact on the country. I'm Beatrice Marshall. Welcome to Talk Africa. Targeting leaders and selected institutions, the two-decade-long embargo has ended up hurting ordinary Zimbabweans more. The measures include a freeze on assets of individuals, visa bans, cessation of defense cooperation, and suspension of government-to-government assistance. They were imposed during the reign of President Robert Mugabe. CGTN's Farai Mwakutuya has more.
Zimbabwe was slapped with sanctions by the European Union and the United States after it implemented a fast-track land reform program in the early 2000s. Though the measures have been progressively eased, the damage wrought over 2 decades has been immense.
We have not received any significant investment over the last, whatever, 10, 15 years, simply because Zimbabwe is seen as a risky destination given that there are sanctions. A lot of banks are no longer dealing with us. So the issue of transactional activity is actually stifled and business transactions are limited because you are labeled as a country under sanctions, and that obviously affects the, you know, the business in the country. So it hurts the economy.
A United Nations rapporteur who visited the country last October gave a harsh assessment of the social impact of the sanctions.
Impeding Zimbabwe's achievement of the Sustainable Development Goals and undermining the right to development of the people of Zimbabwe.
Analysts believe the restrictive measures have failed to punish the intended targets to the detriment of ordinary citizens.
The elite in these countries have got a lot of money, and they've got money offshore, they've got money elsewhere. Any particular sanctions allows them to actually have alternatives, whereas individuals who are in a particular country under sanctions and are suffering because of those particular sanctions have no option.
Almost all facets of life have been impacted.
There are few jobs. Crime has increased as people look for ways to survive. The quality of our children's education has suffered. We've experienced shortages of basic commodities and our industrial base shrunk.
For some, the measures are necessary.
The economy is suffering in Zimbabwe because our politics is so toxic. Sanctions are coming in to level the playing field and to leave, to make politicians to account for their actions.
The government says it has implemented reforms to open up democratic space and continues to engage the West to normalize relations.
Zimbabwe has recently been emboldened and may feel vindicated in its fight against the sanctions after member states of the Southern African Development Community declared October 25th as the day on which all countries in the region will stand with Zimbabwe in calling for the immediate and unconditional removal of the measures. Farai Mwakutuya, CGTN, Harare, Zimbabwe.
Well, Zimbabwe's economy has been in free fall now for over two decades. Before we begin our discussions with my panel today, let's hear something from the Deputy Minister for Foreign Affairs and International Trade from Zimbabwe. He's the Honourable Musabayana David. Honourable Deputy Minister, thank you very much for joining us on Talk Africa today. I want first to start off by looking at the impact of sanctions on Zimbabwe. What is your view on the sanctions, and is there still justification for the continuation of the sanctions?
Beatrice, Zimbabwe has been under illegal and unfair economic sanctions for close to a quarter of a century now. These sanctions are illegal because they were not sanctioned. They were not approved by the United Nations. And these sanctions were imposed using a wrong and wrongful basis, because Zimbabwe had reclaimed its land, which was part of the Lancaster House Agreement of the 21st of December 1979, and where United States of America and the United Kingdom agreed and offered as the guarantors to this conference that they will compensate the farmers who had illegally taken away land from the indigenous Zimbabweans. So Zimbabwe was penalized for implementing what was agreed, because the United States of America and Britain reneged from that agreement. Up to today, they have never compensated a single cent. Now, fast forward, these sanctions have been claimed to be targeted and having not impacting on the general and the general civic society of Zimbabwe.
Honorable Deputy Minister, you know, the sanctions you've talked about go back to 2001, and they were imposed under the leadership of the late President Mugabe. There has been a change of leadership since then, but the sanctions have not been lifted. Why haven't the sanctions been removed?
Now that these sanctions were imposed on a certain dispensation, and that dispensation has since been removed, and we have a new leadership under the President Dr. Edi Mnangagwa, who has come up with a slew of reforms, and these reforms we expected were going to aid in the removal of function, and indeed with the EU we've made some progress, where most of the people have now been, all the people have now been freed from the sanctions. We've started training, trading and doing business with the EU. But with the United States of America, they still renewed the sanctions a few weeks ago, where they are saying they are renewing the data for another 12 months. This is confusing because in terms of electoral reforms they've been put in place, space has been opened up for the opposition parties. We've also realized that a lot does happen on our social media, on Twitter and whatever. People say whatever they want with government or against certain government officials, right, even the head of state. But we've seen democracy prevailing. But still, sanctions are still renewed by United States of America. So they are keep on shifting goalposts and also changing the terms of reference when it comes to the renewal of these economic sanctions.
So a very final question to you, Honorable Deputy Minister. You know, there are two arguments of thought regarding the sanctions against Zimbabwe. One side says that, you know, it is really part of the government mismanagement and corruption that is causing the economic meltdown in Zimbabwe. You know, are the sanctions really to blame, or is it mismanagement and corruption from your government?
We don't have missing management of the economy. Why? Because I've highlighted that we had a twin deficit, where we had a fiscal deficit and a trade deficit. But all the deficits have been reversed. In terms of the budget, we are now operating on a surplus, where we only eat what we have killed. Although people have been disputing that because of lack of understanding. But it just goes to show that government is not over-borrowing. In terms of the trade deficit, we have reduced it from 1.6 billion to less than 500 million. That's tremendous stride. Under conditions of economic sanctions, under conditions where almost every 2 years we have had drought, almost we have also been just coming out of Cyclone Idai, where we deployed a lot of resources towards it. So we are saying we don't have credit line, we don't have any grants that were being given by the international community. But over and above that, we have scored an economic growth that was underpinned or affirmed by the World Bank of 7.8%. And they themselves said this was the biggest growth in Africa. So where does mismanagement come from? You can't say you are mismanaging an economy and that economy is registering economic growth. A symptom of a mismanagement, mismanaged economy is a ballooning budget deficit, a ballooning trade deficit, hyperinflation. I have said from 2017, 2018 to now, inflation has fallen from 800% to around 60%. That's good management of the economy. In terms of corruption, we've seen government ministers, more than four ministers, losing their cabinet position. It has never happened. It has not happened in many countries in the world where a president fired the people that he would have appointed because of corruption. We've also seen government officials being dismissed for misdemeanors or corruption. That is a good sign that economy is more managed and we are dealing with corruption. As you know, corruption is a cancer that has affected the whole world. But we have made tremendous strides under the leadership of President Dr. Idi Mnangagwa.
Thank you so much for joining us on the program, the Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs and International Trade from Zimbabwe. And on that note, let's take a short break. And when we come back, we'll be joined by our panel and we'll look into why the sanctions have not been removed and what it would take to lift Zimbabwe out of its economic crisis. Stay with us. Well, let's now bring in our panel, all joining via Zoom. Joining me from Polokwane, Professor Ricky Mukonza, Senior Lecturer in Politics and Public Affairs, Shwane University. And in Johannesburg, Rutendo Matinyarare, Marketing Strategist and Anti-Sanctions Campaigner. A warm welcome to you both to the program. Let me start off with you, Professor Mukonza. Looking at those sanctions imposed on Zimbabwe since way back in 2001, are those sanctions helping Zimbabweans at all?
I think by and large, sanctions that were imposed on Zimbabwe are not in any way helping Zimbabweans. If anything, they are giving the ruling elite an excuse for misgovernance. They are giving the ruling elite you know, cheap campaigning material. If you look at the material conditions, nothing really has changed for the people of Zimbabwe. If anything, things have gone worse. But why I further say sanctions are not working is that the so-called targeted people, those that are targeted with sanctions, are not affected in any way. They continue to live in their lavish ways. So by and large, I argue that the sanctions as an instrument to influence political behavior of the ruling elite in Zimbabwe have not worked.
Rutendo, what's your view here? Is there a justification of the continued imposition of these sanctions?
The special rapporteur of the UN Human Rights Council came to Zimbabwe and declared the sanctions upon Zimbabwe illegal. There are also a number of resolutions that include 44-215 and 34-13 that have said that unilateral sanctions imposed by nations upon other nations without the consultation of the UN and without the UN instituting those sanctions is illegal. So sanctions are not a tool to try and influence political behavior, because in 1989 they created a resolution that is called 44-215 that actually outlawed the use of coercive economic measures, especially upon third world countries that were former colonies, by Western countries to influence their political demeanor. So the UN felt that Western countries were utilizing the power that they accumulated from colonialism to actually continue to administer their former colonies by utilizing these coercive measures. So they're illegal. And they also are collective punishment of civilians, thus crimes against humanity by persecution. There is no way that a crime against humanity such as persecution can be used to bring any change that is positive. In fact, it is a form of illegal warfare according to the Geneva Convention.
So what I'm hearing, Rutendo, though, is that the sanctions at this point against Zimbabwe are actually being used, you know, as a tool, as a symbolic tool, not really to achieve the intended means. I mean, did the sanctions here then miss the target of what they were intended to do?
They are not missing the target of what they intended to do, because sanctions were imposed on Zimbabwe to give an advantage to the opposition members. They were targeted on the government of Zimbabwe, its institutions, its parastatals, to cripple that government from undertaking the delivery of services and the development of the country, so that the Zimbabwean people would be frustrated and then vote for the opposition political parties. So it's a form of terrorism, if not a form of persecution or punishment of civilians to force them to vote for the opposition. And in that way, it has actually helped the opposition to manage all our urban municipalities, which we believe is a contravention of international law. It is a contravention of human rights when a political party can use coercive economic measures and persecution to force people to vote for it.
Professor Rukonza, is that your thoughts as well? Like, this has actually given the opposition an edge, and it was supposed to give to make some sort of regime change in Zimbabwe at the time.
Sanctions were meant to, you know, influence certain political behavior that started developing in Zimbabwe. You would recall that around 2000, probably others would even, you know, link the sanctions to the land reform. But I more specifically want to talk of the political, you know, developments that we saw around 2000 with the elections that took place around that time. We saw the violence that ensued. We saw the alleged, we also heard of the alleged, you know, unfair electoral practices that were, you know, giving an advantage to the ruling party.
Right.
We saw a lot of things that, were not only, you know, a problem to outsiders, but were also a problem to Zimbabweans themselves.
So
a very good section of Zimbabweans themselves. So sanctions, in my opinion, came in to try and correct that behavior. To say, you know, those that are at the helm, or those that are, you know, are pushing or are seen as leading this, this violence, this vote rigging and so forth, need to change their political behavior. This is where I came in and said the sanctions were meant to correct certain political behavior.
Did it change that behavior, though? Did it correct that political behavior?
Unfortunately, they did not. We must admit that behavior still continues. We know that just recent at a rally in Kwekwe for the opposition political party, the coalition, Citizen Coalition for Change, we saw the violence that ensued there, and we also know of the alleged vote rigging that took place in the 2018 election, general election. So by and large, it hasn't really, influenced the political elite to change as was desired.
Let me hear Rutendo's view here. If it hasn't motivated the political elite to change their behavior, so then why are the ordinary Zimbabweans then left to suffer? Because, it is now said that today half of Zimbabwe's 13.5 million people are living below the poverty line as a result of sanctions and other factors.
I think the claim to say that sanctions were imposed to change behavior is disingenuous, and it is disingenuous because we live in a nation and a world that confines itself to rule of law. And according to rule of law, the United States, the Europeans, and no individual country has the right to actually try and engineer or change the workings of a sovereign nation by utilizing means such as coercion, economic coercion, or warfare. So if there was a problem in Zimbabwe, there are mechanisms within the international sphere that could have been utilized, like the International Court of Justice, the Human Rights Council, to investigate these human rights violations and this so-called violence. None of that ever took place. And the question we ask is, why did people not approach the Human Rights Council of the UN to undertake an investigation of the claims of this election rigging, the claims of this human rights violation, instead of Western countries that used to be our colonizers, the ones that used to perpetrate crimes against humanity, undertaking their own mob justice upon Zimbabwe? And there's been no answer to that. The claim of electoral rigging can be tested in courts of law in Zimbabwe. The presidential elections were contested in 2018. There was a dispute, and it was taken to the Constitutional Court. The opposition lost because they could not prove vote rigging was taking place. So the reason why there's been no change is because the grounds upon which people are saying that sanctions were imposed are false. They are false. They are based on allegations that have never been tested in any court. They're based on allegations that have never been tried and evidence never been provided. And that's why there can be no change for any reason based on allegations that have brought about these sanctions.
Professor Mukonda, your thoughts here, because now that has been put to the test.
I also believe that Wallace Rutendo has the right to disagree with me, but I think it is also disingenuous to deny evidence that is before us of electoral violence that has bedeviled Zimbabwe since 2000, evidence of killing and maiming on the basis of political difference is something that can be one can just do a simple internet search and find that information. Evidence is abound on those issues.
Rutendo, I mean, does Zimbabwe, though, if you go back to say these are some of the issues that can be tested in a court of law, does Zimbabwe have those institutions, or did Zimbabwe have those institutions to test the evidence that Professor Mukonda is talking about?
Zimbabwe is one of the countries with the least crime in the African continent because our legal system works, our law enforcement works. So the excuse of people utilizing allegations as fact is something that doesn't make sense, because the reason why courts exist, the reason why the word due process exists, is so that allegations can be tested in a court of law. And if courts of laws in Zimbabwe are not working, there are mechanisms within the UN, there are mechanisms within the UN Human Rights Council. We've got offices of the UN in Zimbabwe. If they felt that Zimbabwe was not following due process, its laws were not working, the country was dysfunctional, they would put in reports into the UN Human Rights Council.
Right.
We know that the United States itself has been taken to the UN Human Rights Council for crimes against humanity and war crimes, and they've been convicted within that particular forum. Right now, we've got the South African government being taken to the International Court of Justice because of the xenophobic violence taking place upon truck drivers in South Africa. But we have never seen the Zimbabwean government being taken to any multilateral forum or any other body to investigate its violations of human rights in Zimbabwe. And what we are saying to Zimbabweans, particularly the opposition, particularly analysts like the professor himself, is that we cannot decide to abrogate a due process when it comes to Zimbabwe just so that we can get and score easy political points.
Professor Mukonza, let me hear your view on this, though. So should the sanctions still remain, even though the initial targets seem not to be changing their ways and probably will not change their ways?
I don't see the necessity of sanctions being maintained. In any case, we have all seen. If anyone had doubted at the beginning, we have now seen that these sanctions are probably not the best instrument to influence change in political behavior among the ruling elites. If anything, I believe these sanctions are giving ZANU-PF an edge. They are giving ZANU-PF an advantage, because each time they go to election and probably they have failed to do certain things, they blame it on sanctions. And for that reason, I'm convinced from where I'm standing that these sanctions are actually aiding ZANU-PF more than they are helping the people of Zimbabwe.
All right. Rutendo, what would it take, though, for Zimbabwe to move forward?
Well, first of all, the removal of sanctions is what it will take for Zimbabwe to move forward. What the professor forgets is that we already have a precedent of the impact of crimes against humanity. So, and the Geneva Convention, which allows nations to go to war, sets rules for countries to fight each other, has actually said that sanctioning people or sanctioning countries, destroying infrastructure, and prohibiting civilians from enjoying their human rights is actually illegal even in wartime, because it has bigger destruction to an economy, to people, and people's lives than even warfare. So we need the sanctions on Zimbabwe to be removed.
All right. Clearly a very interesting discussion here. But I want to get your final remarks to both of you. And because, you know, there is an agreement, though, that sanctions against Zimbabwe, at least from the both of you, must be removed. Is there room for dialogue domestically and with international partners at this point? What options, Professor Mukonza, does Zimbabwe have as we speak?
I think chances of dialogue from where I'm sitting, are very slim, because if we take the internal political players, they are far from each other, at least from what we see in the public domain. They are far from each other. I mean, we can't even talk about bringing in externals, because what I think should happen first is that internal role players themselves should have a common understanding that they need to sit down and agree on a common goal, find each other and begin to forge, like what happened with in 2008 with the Global Political Agreement.
Right.
Everyone within the country had seen the need, but I don't see it being present in the current political situation.
Rutendo, you have the final word. I just want to know from you, what recourse does Harare have at this point when it comes to the sanctions?
The recourse that is there is legal action, International Court of Justice, and also undertaking legal action like we are currently doing in South Africa and other jurisdictions against the illegality of these sanctions that has been determined by the UN Human Rights Council, plus a number of other laws that already exist. Because of this duress of sanctions, because of the duress of threats of military invasion, this opposition, the Constitution of Zimbabwe, must be nullified so that we restore democracy in Zimbabwe. So the removal of these criminals from our political system is a starting point and recourse for us as Zimbabweans. And I think you saw how difficult these people are when you wanted to just bring them here to give their side of the story. And they ran away from having an engagement like this because they are not dialogue people. They are people that believe in using the duress of their Western powers in order for them to get what they want. The dialogue in Zimbabwe can be had with other political players. I do not believe that we can have dialogue with the West, because the West needs to continue its parasitic relationship with Africa. And Zimbabwe is a country that has refused hegemony, suzerainty, and this parasitic relationship in which the West want to control our resources and we become slaves. That's never going to happen. So we can never get into an agreement with the West as long as they want to prey on Western countries for them to maintain their high standards of living.
Professor Mukonza and Rutenda, to you both, thank you very much for a lively discussion. But that's all we have time for this week on the program. A big thank you to our panel of experts in Polokwane, Professor Ricky Mukonza, Senior Lecturer in Politics and Public Affairs, Shishiwane University. And in Johannesburg, Rutendo Matinyarare, Marketing Strategist and Anti-Sanctions Campaigner. Remember, you can be a part of this conversation through our social media platforms on Facebook and Twitter. And you can watch this and other editions of Talk Africa on our YouTube playlist. Do join us again next week for more Talk Africa. From me, Beatrice Marshall, and the team here in Nairobi, until next time, goodbye.
That was a Africa Talk program from CGTN on the impact of Western economic sanctions against the Republic of Zimbabwe and Southern Africa. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of our program. Phyllis Hyman and Deliver the Love. And right now we want to move into our Women's History Month segment for this month, March of 2022. This is an interview with Miss Willie Mae Thornton that we ran partially in the previous program, which was cut short. So we'll listen again to this interview in its totality. Let's listen in.
Well, Mae, why don't we start off where you were born? Can you tell me a little bit about where were you born and when? What's your birthday?
11th of December.
11th of December?
Yeah, 11th of December. An Alabama kid.
Where? What town in Alabama were you
born? Montgomery.
In Montgomery. What was the year of your birthday? Mind telling us how old you are?
Well, that's a secret.
That's a secret. We'll never find out. what did your folks do? Did any of them play music or sing? Or?
Well, my father, he was a minister. My mother, she's a Christian-hearted working woman. She sang Christian songs.
Did you ever sing with them in the church or when you were youngster?
Well, no, not exactly. I used to go to church a lot, but just singing, you know, I didn't do too much singing in church.
Did you grow up in the town of Montgomery or did you?
I left there when I was 14.
Oh, you left there when you were 14?
Yeah.
Did you leave with your folks or just take off on your own?
No, I left with a show.
Oh, you left with a show? What was that? What was the name of it?
The Samuel Green's Hot Harlem Review.
Hmm.
Out of Atlanta, Georgia.
Is that right? How did they happen to find you? Did they hear you singing someplace?
Well, I did audition on his show when he was playing a little theater there in the hometown.
Oh, is that right? Hmm. And where did you tour?
We went Atlanta, Birmingham, and back home, and Columbus, Georgia, Macon, Georgia, North, South Carolina, Florida. We just toured practically everywhere.
What year was this roughly? Can you tell us?
Well, in...
Before the war?
I started before the war. And then after the war broke out, then we went to and through Texas.
Hmm. What sort of things was this kind of a minstrel show or was it just a music?
Well, a stage show, like, you know, playing in theaters.
Did they have dancers and comics and all that?
Yeah, dancers, course girls, comedians, singers.
And how long did you stay with them?
Well, up until 48. That's when I left in Houston. I quit the show in Houston, Texas.
Did you go on your own from there in Houston?
Well, in Houston, I started recording records for Don Robey before I recorded from him, but he came out to the club I was working called the El Dorado Ballroom there on Elgin and Darlin to hear me sing. And right then, he wanted me under a contract, but I didn't sign right then.
Good. Who was some of the other people with you there at the time? Was it your band or did you just play as?
No, I was playing with a group called Smiley. Ike Smalley. He was the band leader there at the El Dorado. That was his band. And then after he left, another band came in, Pluma Davis and his rock. We called them the House Rockers, and they were doing pretty nice.
who were some of the other singers around town that you remember around 48 around Houston?
Around Houston then? Well, Gate Mouth Brown, he was real hot there. He was on Peacock label. And Roy Brown, he was in town. He was pretty hot around in that length of time. And I got a chance to meet Louis Jordan when he come to town. Big Joe Turner. And
he used to be a real favorite around Houston, didn't he?
Fats Domino, he was working around. That's when he put out this record. They called me the Fat Man.
Oh, yeah. Hmm. And How long did you stay around Houston then?
Well, in 51, I cut this record, Let Your Tears Fall, Baby. And I went to San Antonio, and I worked down there. I worked in San Antonio for a while. And when I came back, I was working around Houston, different little nightclubs. And Johnny Otis, he came in town. That was in 52. So we did an audition on his show that night. When I was working with Gate Mob Brown, he wanted me to sing with his band. So I did a song with his band. And he liked the way I performed on the stage, so he hired me. So he took me on tour, New York.
Well, you toured with Johnny mm-hmm. Otis' band then?
Yeah, that's when I first went to the Apollo Pit in 52.
Oh, is that right? Mm-hmm. And did you also go to Los Angeles then?
Or? Well, we left Houston, and we went to Los Angeles. And while I was there, we recorded Hound Dog, but Don Roby put it on the shelf. So we go from Los Angeles, played in California. We played the tour here, Sweets Ballroom, San Francisco, the Fillmore Auditorium. Then we go back to Los Angeles, and then we leave Los Angeles and go back through Houston, Texas, Battling the Blues with Gate Mob Brown. Then we leave there, and we goes on through Florida, then on back up on around the East Coast there, coming into New York. It goes into Apollo. That was in June 52. So the last part of 52, we goes Providence, Rhode Island, and all the England states, Boston, Massachusetts, and all around up through that.
And,
so we leave Providence, that's pretty close to Christmas. And I was supposed to go back. At least I wanted to go home. Kind of homesick, so I wanted to see the old gang. So I called a train. I leave New York, come back to Houston. And I got there just a little before Christmas. So Don Roby, he put me on a show in his nightclub. And I worked at Christmas and at New Year's out to his club. That's before they tore it down. It's called the Peacock. The Bronze Peacock, and they tore it down and made the office out of it. Now, it's a big office where they cut records. They got a record studio in there where they record. And back in the back, they press their own records. In 1953, that's when I met Johnny Ace. So they sent me to Dayton, Ohio. That's where I joined him there. Playing, perform there at the theater there. I forget the name of the theater. But anyway, I was going to the theater, and I just turned the radio on in the car. And the man said, here's a record that's nationwide, Hound Dog by Willie Mae Thornton. I said, that's me. I hadn't heard the record in so long. So when we got to the theater, they was blasting it. You could hear it from the theater, from the loudspeaker on out. Oh, they just playing Hound Dog all over the theater. So I goes up in the operating room. I said, you mind play that again? Because the man held the record so long, I forgot the words myself. So I was up in the so I stood there while he was playing it, listening to it. So that evening, I sang it on the show. And everybody went for it. So Hound Dog just took off like a jet. Right now, I wish I'd get another dog with cat or something.
And then I guess you toured around, and when did you finally come back out here again?
Well, before I came out here, I went back into the Apollo Theater in February '55. And when I came back, I toured around up that part of the country. That's when I ran into Big Maybell when I was battling the blues. So, well, that tour ended that way, so I drove on back down through Alabama, Georgia, stopping over, seeing friends, because I didn't have anything else to do. So I goes back to Houston. Well, we go on a tour with Gate Mob Brown. I work around with him during 56, the first part of 56. Around Thanksgiving, I came out here, and I haven't been back.
Mm-hmm. how did Robi used to book you? Did he have a booking agency?
Yeah, well, Don Robi didn't actually book me. Evelyn Johnson was booking the old Buffalo booking agents.
Oh, I see. That isn't run by Robi as much.
Well, I don't know whether he had anything to do with it or not, but it's coming out of his office there.
Yeah.
You know, out of the Peacock, you know, the establishment.
They're
called.
They're his artists, yeah. And how did you pick up most of your songs? Did you?
Well, some I wrote myself. Some other people, you know, write and I sang them. And,
like about that Hound Dog and I Smell Rat, were those two writers there? Did they just happen to be there? Or?
Well, Jerry Lieber, he wrote Hound Dog and I Smell a Rat. Jerry Lieber, Mike Stroll, they wrote that, those two numbers there.
Mm-hmm.
And they wrote both sides of that record, if I'm not mistaken. Nightmare was on the first Hound Dog, they wrote both sides of that record.
Mm-hmm. Were they from Houston or what?
No, actually, they are right now. They're from New York, but they were staying in Los Angeles at the time when they.
Oh, I see. They were.
You know, yeah, they were down in Los Angeles. They know Johnny Otis very well, you know.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. Because they've written a lot of songs, like for the Coasters. I think they wrote that Yakety Yak.
Yeah, and I know it wrote quite a bit.
Yeah, yeah. who were some of your favorite singers when you were a youngster? You know, when you were just growing up.
Well, I didn't have no favorite singer. I just admired good singing, you know. But since...
Did you hear anybody you liked when you were in Birmingham still? Or?
No. Well, and my favorite blues artists were Muddy Waters and Big Maceo and be surprised, Lowell Fulsom. All the cats, man, I admired them, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Roy Brown, I sang all of his songs.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I didn't have no hit records, but I was singing everybody else's records.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I went into the Apollo Theater, you'd be surprised what I went over with, big.
Mm-hmm.
Have Mercy, Mercy Baby by the Dominoes.
Oh, yeah.
Billy Ward the Domino. That time when Clyde McFadden was there with him, you know.
Yeah, I sure remember. That's about the time I, you know, got interested.
That was the first time I'd ever been to New York.
That song might actually be a good song for you to redo, that Have Mercy, Mercy, Baby.
Yeah, that's a nice tune. I like
yeah,
that.
I have that record here. Let's see. What did your parents think of it when you started singing kind of blues and that church music?
Well, I lost my mother in 39. Well, I wasn't singing. I wasn't singing blues when I was then. No, I wasn't doing anything. We're just staying around home. Time ran.
Is that when you left home after your mother died?
No, I didn't leave right away.
Hmm.
I didn't leave right away.
But you said that you like to sing, you know, gospel songs. Have you ever, you know, seriously thought about, you know, making maybe some records of you know, spirituals and gospel songs?
I've thought about it a great deal. And I would like very much to do spirituals. Because I feel that I got the voice. I feel like I got the power. I just feel like I can just do them. I just like in a fire condition. You'd be surprised. Mostly my occupation every morning is turn on my radio, listen to spirituals. I love those spirituals. I love good singing. And like the Dixie Hummingbirds, the Soul Stirrers, Mahalia Jackson, the Davis Sisters. Oh, man. I mean, and the Five Blind Boys of Mississippi. Oh, they just knocked me out, I'm telling you. When I hear good singing, I love it. In fact, and I love all good singing.
Yeah, I think that's the way I think. You mean you sort of really got into blues because people wanted you to sing them more or less, and rather than...
Well, how I got into blues, because I didn't know anyone at the time to to do what I wanted to do. And back in this, and when you're hungry, you try to make a fast buck to try to stop from being hungry.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I hope that you can, you know, do the things that you want to do as far as I'm concerned. You know, I'd like to make some righteousness, do whatever you want to do. I mean, that's the way I look at it.
I would like very much to cut some spirituals. Get me a good group behind me and cut some nice old time records, you know, spiritual records, because I like good singing.
I guess you don't want to talk too much about your early days. I'm always interested, you know, how people get started and how what you hear around you. I mean, you didn't hear much except your family and people and singing in church and so on.
No, not too much about that.
Hmm. Who else was on that show that you auditioned for when you started? Were there any names that I may recognize?
Yeah, a young man was singing on the show at the time called Billy Wright.
Oh,
yeah. He made a nice hit record. And he was doing real nice on that. He got on Savoy label, and he was doing pretty nice on that.
Mm.
I haven't heard from Billy in quite a while.
Mm. But you don't remember hearing any low-down blues guys around your hometown?
No.
Guys like... Muddy Waters, in that style. You didn't have
to well, and Muddy Waters and Jimmy Reed wasn't, I didn't hear of him until lately here.
Yeah.
Well, Muddy Waters, he was out. He was doing something. Howlin' Wolf, they was doing, they was on label.
Yeah, but you didn't hear any local people down there?
No. The only thing I heard local was some spiritual
mm-hmm.
quartets, and I don't forget the name of that, been so long.
Yes, it's very strange that there's so few, you know. Most of the blues singers seem to come out of Mississippi or Texas.
Well, I haven't, you know, I didn't get to you know, hear anything about nothing like that until after I had started singing and was already gone away. And then
mm-hmm.
and people tell me, say, well, I'm from Montgomery, I'm from Alabama or, you know,
mm-hmm.
Tennessee. But I didn't know anything about them, you know, because they came along behind me.
How did you meet up with this fellow, Brad Taylor? Yeah.
Oh, Brad Taylor? He got a record on the shelf. Do you know that Sentimental Reason thing I used to do? I cut a tape on that, and he, I don't know what he did. I guess he wore the tape out. He won't release the record.
Did you meet him when you worked in San Francisco again?
Yeah, I met Brad while I was working in Santa Cruz, San Francisco, around the Bay Area here.
Mm-hmm. Anything you want to tell us about yourself to us? Maybe you want to tell the world about it.
Yeah, I need a job. I need a job. I need help. Help.
Yeah.
See, so many youngsters jumping up now. They forget about the old timers,
yeah,
and right now they'd be surprised that the old timers got more to offer than some of those youngsters.
And I noticed that, you know, things are changing so fast, it seems like even people like Charles Brown, you know, and everybody...
Yeah, you don't...
Just, you know,
that's right.
Big artists like yourself, and all of a sudden all these crop of new kids coming in, and it's so hard to...
You know, if people will just come out and listen to the old-timers, and they'll realize that they can... Old-timers are still going.
Yeah,
me, all I just need to break. All I want to do is put something out there that means just let me sit down and just take my time, put some good background behind it, and let me just show the world what I got. That's all I want.
Yeah. Well, I hope we'll be able to do that.
Let's go to show you. Now, like you singing on the stage. Now, on the stage... I can perform 40 minutes and never say the same thing twice. See, it just comes to me like that.
Yeah.
And I can just start to sing it and make a song right on the stage. And I think just making up a song on the stage and you get that feeling and got somebody behind you that groovy, it comes out much better anyway. Because to my idea, to like a person write a song, they have given me songs, and I wind up changing that song completely. Because to my idea, it's just like when I made this Summertime. I didn't do it like everybody else do it. I do it different. And the flip side, called Truth Comes to the Light, the man that wrote that side, he gave me the words and I changed it around completely. Mm-hmm. And Truth Comes to the Light, was, to me, to my idea, it sounded better than Summertime.
I've heard the Summertime once, so I can Lucky Ones play. I've been meaning to get that record.
And this new record, I got an answer to Hound Dog called Tomcat.
Oh, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Have they put that out?
Well, they released it the day, and I said, say, my president got assassinated. And so that stopped that.
Welcome back. Voice of Miss Willie Mae Thornton, better known as Big Mama Thornton. And that was an interview from the 1970s. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast. We are commemorating Women's History Month. And we're going to take a break with Mary Stafford, and I'm going to jazz my way from 1921. We'll be back.
They call the doctor in from far and wide.
the voice of Mary Stafford from 1921, I'm Gonna Jazz My Way, one of the early hit records from the African-American women blues singers of the 1920s. And right now we want to continue Women's History Month commemorations. This is a focus on the Phyllis Wheatley Club, which is part of the National Association of Colored Women, national African-American women's organization that began in 1896 and continued and still continues to the 21st century. This is a focus on the Phyllis Wheatley Club, as well as one of the key leaders of the period, and that's Mary B. Talbert. Let's listen in.
Hello, and welcome to the Buffalo History Museum's M&T Third Friday program. My name is Matt Holland. I am the program and volunteer coordinator here. Tonight we have a pre-recorded presentation from Dr. Barbara Seals Nevergold, historian, activist, educator, and co-founder of the Uncrowned Queens Institute. She will be presenting on the Phyllis Wheatley Club. We hope you enjoy. Thanks.
Thank you, Matt, for that introduction. I want to thank also the Buffalo History Museum for the opportunity to talk about an organization and tell the story about an organization of African-American women who persisted through many trials and tribulations and made tremendous contributions to the African-American community and to the community at large in Buffalo. The Phyllis Wheatley Club. And still, they persisted. In 1999, I was introduced perhaps to an activity of the Phyllis Wheatley Club that I was not aware of. Now, this is about 100 years after the organization was founded. And at that point in 1999, I was part of an organization called the Women's Pavilion Pan Am 2001. We were planning a series of observation activities that were going to commemorate and celebrate the role that women played in the Pan American Exposition of 1901. And one of the members of that organization told me about a protest rally that had been held by a group of Black women. And I thought, wow, 1900, you had Black women that had the audacity to stage a protest rally. And so as we talked a little bit more about these women, and they are obviously the Phyllis Wheatley Club, we also talked about the fact that what they were doing was trying to advocate, or they were advocating, for the placement of the Negro exhibit at the Pan American Exposition. And at the time, that exhibit was in Paris, at the Paris exhibition. So that sparked my interest and began my journey, I would say, to finding out more about this organization. Now, as I said, they were organizing in 1900, 1899, but they were an affiliate of a national organization that wasn't too much older, the National Association of Colored Women's Clubs. So let's talk a little bit about that organization, because it's important to understand the foundation for the Phyllis Wheatley Club being the NACW. The NACW really formed in 1896 in response to a public letter that was written by an individual by the name of James Jacks, a journalist who was the president of the Missouri Press Association. And Mr. Jacks wrote this letter that described African-Americans as being liars and thieves, and the women especially as being prostitutes. You can imagine the uproar that caused within the Black community. I would also point out, before I go on, to say a little bit more about that spark that ignited in the community and started the National Association of Colored Women's Clubs, that Black women had been organizing even before emancipation, certainly in the North. Those free Black women were organizing and forming self-help groups that provided mutual aid, that provided assistance and benefits to the community. And they have been doing this for many years, as well as cultural, hosting cultural events for themselves and for the community. So they were not strangers at all to the club movement, but there was not a national organization until the National Federation of Afro-American Women, the National League of Colored Women, and the New Era Club came together to formulate the National Association of Women's Clubs. And you can see that their goal was broadly, you know, again, to inform, educate, uplift, support, not just women, but through women's activities, the community, and the morality, the religious and social welfare of members of the community, and protect the rights of women and children in the community, and to educate. They had as their motto, lifting as we climb, indicating that what they saw as the responsibility of women, to particularly those women who were more advantaged, to go back and to uplift other members of the race. And so this is how the Phyllis Wheatley Club then became part of the National Association of Colored Women's Clubs. In 1899, they formed in Buffalo, and they were the first affiliate of the NACW to form in Buffalo, although not the last one. There were several others. I found this photo of the Phyllis Wheatley Club in a newspaper in 1900, March of that year, as a matter of fact. And as you can see, the women posed for this photo, and they did so in what they called their clubhouse. And interestingly enough, their clubhouse was the Michigan Street Baptist Church. And so I have a photo of the church without the club members and with the club members. Also, I want to point out that in 1901, the population of Buffalo was 352,000 people at that point, with the African American population being 1,698 thereabouts. And so for these women to form a club movement that had the strength of numbers for them, and at some point in 1900, they did not have 150 women, but shortly thereafter, somewhere a year later, they had 150 members in the organization, which is significant. And so they were able to wield, I think, a lot of influence with that number, even though the numbers of African Americans were fairly small. I have a photo, too, of Mary Burnett Talbert here. Mrs. Talbert is a legend. She's not as well known as she should be, I think, as a leader in movements. And we'll talk more about her leadership. But she was the first secretary of the Phyllis Wheatley Club in Buffalo. And as we talk about her and as we look at her accomplishments and her contributions, she was destined, certainly, to be a leader in the club movement and elsewhere. Technology. Okay, going forward, I just pulled this article from an October 28th newspaper, and this is just one of the newspapers featuring an announcement about the launch of the club on that date in 1899. And I think it's significant in that it shows sophistication of the women in recognizing that they needed to publicize what they were doing to get support for it. And so they became very adept at PR, making sure they got their activities publicized. Getting started, They may have launched in October 1899, but it was obvious that they really were already planning many, many activities, and they hit the ground running. Of course, first on their agenda was to invite the National Association of Colored Women's Clubs to hold its national convention in Buffalo during the Pan American Exposition. So they extended an invitation to the organization immediately to do that. They also advocated for inclusion in the Pan Am, not just for exhibits, but also for employment and other opportunities that they envisioned would come as a result of this World's Fair. They looked at education as, again, one of their major goals, and so they placed books by Black authors in libraries and schools. They organized what they called mothers' clubs to teach parenting. They set up food drives and food giveaways, and didn't just limit it to the African-American poor in the community. They advocated for suffrage, and this year is really critical in the suffrage movement, and that we are in 2020, we're celebrating the centennial of women getting the vote, but not all women got the vote in 1920. African-American women didn't get the vote. Nonetheless, these women persisted in supporting suffrage for women, and they wanted also suffrage for men. So that came later, of course, for African-Americans. And they also began fundraising efforts because they had a plan to create and develop a settlement home. So here we have the outside of their clubhouse, the Michigan Street Baptist Church, and this is about how it looked at that time. And as I said, you know, the advocacy for inclusion in activities in the Pan Am started just about when the group started in 1899. But by the next year, they didn't see the progress and the success they wanted. And so they decided that they were going to launch a protest rally. And again, that was a bold move, an audacious move for Black women at that time, probably any women at that time. But they did so. And while their goal was to get engagement and to get the Negro exhibit brought to the fair, and that exhibit really was important, was critical in that it showed progress that African Americans had made since emancipation. In 1900, what the women were seeing was that there were only two exhibits that were coming to the fair for sure, representing African Americans, and both were pejoratives or did not certainly show African American progress. One was the Old Plantation, and the other was Darkest Africa. Both exhibits on the Midway, where a great number of people would see them, over 8 million people came to the Pan American Exposition, and I would bet close to 8 million people went to the Midway. These exhibits were exhibits that were peopled, you could say, by people. In other words, they were inhabitants and residents that lived in these exhibits. On the Old Plantation, they had log cabins. They also had theaters in both of these exhibits where the individuals who were housed in the exhibits did shows, dances, either of the slave dances or of the savage dances were done. They also had souvenir shops where they made implements and sold them to people. The Old Plantation even had a cotton field. Can you imagine a cotton field in Buffalo? But they did. And so these were considered to be reflections of African Americans at some point in history. But again, they were not reflective of where African Americans were in 1900. And so this is where the protest rally comes into play, and where Mary B. Talbert, as the spokesperson for the Phyllis Wheatley Club, gave a presentation which she entitled, Why the Afro-American should be represented at the Pan Am Expo. Now, unfortunately, this presentation has been lost to history. We don't have a copy of it. Newspaper accounts citing the protest rally and talking about a little bit about Mrs. Talbert's remarks indicated that she certainly said detailed, quote, what she considered to be the essential requisites of such an exhibit. And I think she entitled the presentation the way she did because in 1893, there was another protest that went on at the Columbia World's Fair, World's Exposition in Chicago at that point. And that protest resulted in a pamphlet produced by Ida B. Wells, which was the reason why the colored American is not at the Columbian World's Fair. Again, the World's Fairs and the ways in which African Americans responded to them were part of a national movement because African Americans realized, one, that as a result of being engaged in these fairs, they would be able to present a positive picture, an image of the accomplishments of African Americans since being freed from slavery. And also, they should be able to benefit in the benefits or the financial and social benefits of the fair. And so they were very adamant, and expos were very frequently held throughout the century. I should also point out, again, and I kind of went past your name, but there were only other, two other speakers at this protest rally, one being a Mrs. A.D. Wilson, who was the president of the Women's Temperance Union. And again, this speaks to the ways in which the Phyllis Wheatley Club reached out to collaborate with other women's organizations, particularly white women's organizations, and to get support from them and to support them in turn. And so Mrs. Wilson is seen at, quite frankly, several events that the organization did and that she supported and gave them, I think, larger credence in the general community. The other speaker was an interesting individual by the name of James A. Ross, who was an attorney, although he didn't practice too much law because he was engaged in any number of careers, but he was a Democratic politician, which was quite unusual at that point since most African Americans were Republican. But Mr. Ross was even at one time considered to be assigned to be the diplomat in Haiti. He was working with the administration of the President Grover Cleveland at that time. For some reason, he declined the appointment, but he was very active nationally in Democratic politics. He also had an idea and a goal and a desire to be the legal exhibit manager. And through the years, there's been some confusion and secrecy around not only whether or not Mr. Ross was the manager, but whether or not the exhibit itself actually came to Buffalo. That was part of my conversation with the Women's Pavilion colleague who first told me about the protest rally and first talked about the Negro exhibit and some question as to whether or not that exhibit really existed. So again, it's kind of part of the mystery that intrigued me about the Pan Am and the role that the Phyllis Wheatley Club played in Pan Am. As you can see, I've listed some other things here that Mr. Ross did. He was an editor and a publisher of a number of newspapers, including the Globe and Freeman, which, interestingly enough, published the pamphlet which accompanied the Negro exhibit at the Pan American Exposition. And that pamphlet itself was also interesting in that it was the only one that had paid advertising in it. Thanks, I think, to to Mr. Ross. But Mr. Ross also defended James B. Parker, the McKinley assassination hero, and even hired Mr. Parker to be a salesman for another newspaper that he published called The Gazetteer and Guide. And I'll say one thing more about Mr. Parker before moving on. I have a picture here of his cigar store. So again, he was an entrepreneur. This photo was actually one of the pictures in the Negro exhibit, which displayed the businesses that African Americans owned. All right, so the women held the protest rally, and it was successful. In December, they found out that the fair managers had agreed to bring the Negro exhibit to Buffalo for the Pan American Exposition. So they didn't rest on their laurels, though. They continued, I think, to develop, again, for the community, a sense that African Americans had more accomplishments and contributions than the old plantation or darkest Africa were going to show them when they went to the fair. So they developed a pageant, which they put on April 19th, 1901, which was actually about 2 weeks before the fair was to open, because the exposition was opening on May 1st. And 30 Years of Freedom was a pageant, as I said, that was organized by the Phyllis Wheatley Club. There were three narrators who introduced each of the acts in the play. Edward Crosby, who was the first journalist hired by the Buffalo Times, first African-American journalist hired by the Buffalo Times newspaper, Mary B. Talbert, again, and Reverend J. Edward Nash, who was the longtime pastor of the Michigan Street Baptist Church. Women, the Phyllis Wheatley Club, again, reached out to women in the community, particularly the socially elite women, who could help support them financially, and asked them to be honorary chairs of this event. It was a fundraising event to raise money, also for the settlement home. And according to the newspapers, it was quite successful. It had between 1,500 and 2,000 individuals attend, mostly white individuals, and as the newspaper said, some better class of the race. They raised about $500. I'm not sure what that translates to in 2020 dollars, but I suspect it was a hefty sum. Again, using their PR, the women got wonderful coverage in the newspapers about the play and about the cause that this play was supporting. As I said, it was a three-act production with eight scenes. It was a cast of 200 men, women, and children who performed in this play. The acts were, as described, to slavery, freedom, education. So in a sense, again, they were laying out the case for the progression of African-American accomplishment and achievement, and they did so by a musical. I love this quote, and I'm sure that the organizers loved it too, in that the newspaper said, "The entertainment opened the eyes of the white folk who saw it. They had no idea that persons of such talent could be found among the colored population of Buffalo." That was in the Express on the 20th. As I said, the Phyllis Wheatley Club was successful in bringing the Negro exhibit to Buffalo, the award-winning exhibit, and received 17 gold medals in Paris. It was coordinated or curated by W.E.B. Du Bois. Now, Mr. Du Bois did not come to Buffalo with the exhibit, but he did send the curator, from the government and Mr. Callahan, who is seated. I'm not sure if he's the one who's seated or standing. The other individual, I believe, is Mr. Ross. We don't have exact confirmation of that. But the exhibit itself, again, featured through displays, through photographs, through scrapbooks, through all kinds of exhibits of artistic and artistic work, sculptural work by African Americans. It was placed in the Liberal Arts Building. So as compared to the Darkest Africa and the old plantation, it was not readily available or seen. It was also made a smaller, was given a smaller footprint than the exhibit in Paris. The Paris exhibit actually had been supported by the federal government, who gave Du Bois $15,000 in order to put this on. So, as I said, it was a major achievement for the women nonetheless, in being able to get the exhibit here. And again, I know that they promoted it as much as they promoted everything that they did. The pamphlet that was produced by Mr. Ross and his newspaper, as I said, for some time was in doubt as to whether or not the Negro exhibit was actually in Buffalo because of its placement and all the controversy associated with it. And this is a story, a publication put out by the Buffalo and Erie County Library, which actually had the original, or has the original pamphlet and scrapbook that has all the pamphlets and publications from the Pan Am. And as the community was getting ready to celebrate the centennial of the Pan Am, this publication was produced that verified the placement of the exhibit, the curator of the exhibit, the ads that were placed, and the fact that the pamphlet was also unusual and that it lists some Buffalo residents, it lists leading Black journals and journalists. Of course, since Mr. Ross was a journalist, he would, of course, make sure that his publications were there. And there were several personal messages from Mr. Ross that were part of this pamphlet, and quite an extraordinary and significant find. And if you ever have an opportunity to get the publication that was done by these, by the library, it certainly is worth taking a look at. All right, so the women were successful in getting the Negro exhibit into Buffalo, but of course they didn't rest on their laurels there. As I said, they had another goal, and that was to get the conference here of the National Association of Colored Women's Clubs, which they again were able to do from July 7th to the 11th. They met in Buffalo, and this is the lovely Mary Church Terrell, and she was the president of the organization at that point, the very first president. She's stepping down, and a new president was being elected. This conference was attended by a number of nationally known prominent women who were all part of the NACW, Mrs. Booker T. Washington, for one, Mrs. Blanche K. Bruce, the widow, one of the first Black representatives in U.S. Congress, Mrs. Rosetta Sprague, who was the daughter of Frederick Douglass. There were 250 delegates and guests who came to this conference, to this convention, and of course that infused Buffalo and the fair with finances. They were welcomed by Mayor Kennedy of Buffalo. As I said, generated a lot of publicity, and they were about their business of working on making sure that they throughout the country coordinated their activities to improve the lives of African Americans and to generate positive imagery of African-American accomplishment. They also had sessions where the issues that were primary importance to them were highlighted, convict lease system, lynching, kindergarten education, parenting. These were all areas under which programs were to be developed. Mary Talbert's presentation was on reasons for placing correct literature before our children. So again, she was involved with Phyllis Wheatley Club, and we find later that she becomes a very integral part of the national organization as well. African American in Buffalo did not stop with, again, advocating for the Negro exhibit or advocating for the conference to come. They were involved and engaged in a lot of entrepreneurial efforts. As a matter of fact, there was a group formed in which they wanted to build a hotel that would be owned and operated by African Americans, and Mr. Ross was involved in that endeavor. But they also got the board of managers to organize or to formulate what they called a committee of comfort. And the committee of comfort was charged with reaching out to African Americans nationally. They sent out letters to black newspapers throughout the country, inviting African Americans to the fair, ensuring them that they would be welcome, ensuring them that they would not be discriminated against, which were some problems that were that they encountered at other fairs, and really worked within the community as well to identify African Americans who would provide housing to visitors when they came in. And the housing wasn't to be free. They were actually renting out to visitors to ensure that there was a broad spectrum and base of homes, of residences and hotels and boarding homes where African American visitors could be welcomed during their stay here in the city for the expo. There were members of the community who bought Pan Am stock. Unfortunately, the Pan Am wasn't financially successful, but at that time, they thought it would be, and the stock was not cheap. It was $10 a stock. And so there were members, however, that were able to invest in the fair, and they did that. They also hosted welcoming parties. Again, trying to encourage and to support African Americans who were visiting the city to ensure that they had a good time, to ensure that they felt welcome to the city. So what was the impact of the African American protest? I think it started with the protest, but certainly, as I indicated, community-wide, there were many activities and many groups who came together and worked with the Phyllis Wheatley Club, worked independently to ensure that African Americans had a place in the Pan American Exposition. We had the successful placement of the Negro exhibit, which is a testament to the results of their advocacy. I just mentioned the Committee of Comfort. Albert Thomas, who also was an attorney. Actually, he was a Yale graduate and a graduate of Fisk University in Nashville, Tennessee. And he was appointed to the Bureau of Information, and he was the highest appointee in the African-American community to work at the fair. There were some other jobs, certainly, that African-Americans got as a result of the fair business. After all, James Parker, the African-American involved in the McKinley assassination, we call him the hero, was the waiter at the fair. I think a major part of what the women did was to ignore the degrading exhibits. In other words, they did not just they focused on the positives of the Negro exhibit, and they downgraded essentially, you know, any attention being paid to the degrading exhibits of the darkest Africa and the old plantation. Their activities and their work established the Phyllis Wheatley Club as a strong advocacy group in the city, and I believe it prepared the community for the Niagara Movement, which we'll talk about in a minute. I mentioned James Benjamin Parker because certainly you can't talk about the Pan-American Exposition without talking about or thinking about the fact that President McKinley was assassinated at that convention, and that his assassination by Leanne Starboss was interrupted was by a man by the name of James Parker, an African-American man, who prevented Starboss from firing the third bullet at McKinley and killing him instantly. However, great controversy occurred around Mr. Parker's acts. He was declared a hero until such time as he was not declared a hero. And there's another 100-year-old plus mystery that has continued to really accompany the history of the Pan-American Exposition. Mr. Parker's story deserves a presentation of its own, and I hope to do that at another time. But we don't want to forget that he had an important role to play at the Pan Am, and when he was discredited by some who felt that he had not actually prevented the assassin from firing the third bullet, the African-American community as a whole were outraged. They were incensed. Nationwide, they were incensed, and there was a lot of work to help to Mr. Parker to tell his story. Ultimately, Mr. Ross stepped in at one point and tried to help Mr. Parker to tell his part of his side of the story and to vindicate him from the backlash he received from people who said he was lying. When Mr. Parker left town, he left to work as a salesman, a traveling salesman for one of the papers that Mr. Ross produced. And as I said, that's a whole other story. Okay. So following their activities in 1901, as I said, these women did not rest on their laurels. They continued to push forward. They continued to work for what they believed was important. And the Michigan Street Baptist Church continued to be a central focus point for their meetings and for their activities. In 1902, they again came to the forefront in another protest in which they protested the fact that they did not believe the police were doing their job. The area between Michigan and Oak Street and Broadway and William Street in Buffalo was a red light district. And that's exactly the area where the church is located. Ms. Talbert lived next door to the church. Mr. Ross lived on the other side of the church. So they certainly had a vested interest in making sure that the red light district, the prostitutes that were in this district, the gambling that went on in houses of ill repute, were addressed by the police. They again protested police inaction and actually an agreement that the police had made with the Anti-Saloon League to essentially look the other way as these houses of ill repute were operating. They collaborated again with white women's groups, and resolution that came from that resulted in the police retracting their stance in the way in which they enforced the law in the red light district, and so that district could be cleaned up. I mentioned a little bit earlier that I thought one of the impacts of the women's activities in the Pan Am contributed to the fact that the Niagara movement took place in Western New York just a few years later. The fact that the women were successful in their protests, the fact that they had a voice, that they made a voice for themselves, and that they could be seen, or Buffalo certainly as a community could be seen as a community that for African Americans was one that could speak up for itself, that could take the bold move of protesting actions and activities that they saw as unjust and discriminatory. In 1905, W.B. Du Bois called together a meeting of men. There were about 40, but only about 29 came to Western New York for what he called the Niagara Movement. And that movement took place, and those meetings took place from July 11th to the 13th. There were a number of reasons, too, other reasons why Du Bois came to Western New York. An Elks Convention was being held at that time, and the cost of a train ticket was extremely, extremely low. And so this was a benefit for men traveling from all over the country to come to Western New York. Buffalo was the center for the second largest, or second busiest, certainly, railroad center in the nation. That was a reason why so many people came to the Pan American, because it was easy to get here and it was inexpensive to get here. But Du Bois also reached out to Mrs. Talbert's husband, and probably to Mrs. Talbert too, to help him to get accommodations for this meeting. And not accommodations in Buffalo necessarily, but accommodations where the men would have plenty of room to deliberate, but also they wanted room to be able to rest and to be able to have activities, fun activities during their in between the times that they were deliberating and planning the Niagara Movement. And so they contacted Mrs. Talbert, I believe, Mr. Talbert. Certainly Mr. Talbert, there's a letter that was written to him by Du Bois. And they actually had the first meeting at the Niagara Movement at 521 Michigan Street, the home of Mary and William Talbert. The members of the Niagara Movement had a vision and had a philosophy that was contrary to Booker T. Washington's. And so there's a major debate that was going on between Du Bois and Washington about what African Americans should do about discrimination and about their rights in this country. Du Bois wanted to advocate for social, civic, political rights immediately, and Washington wanted African Americans to concentrate on self-help and on preparation, education, and preparation for the workforce as primary, and not to concentrate on issues of equality in politics or in social equality. So this divide between the two men was quite prominent for a period of time, and Washington did not support the Niagara Movement. The Niagara Movement was essentially the forerunner of the NAACP, and it existed for about 5 years before it dissolved, but nonetheless it laid the basis for the modern civil rights movement and the NAACP, and had strong connections to Western New York, to individuals in the Western New York community, and certainly I believe to the Talberts. And as you can see here, from the Pan Am protests of the Niagara movement, there is a connection. The first year that the Niagara movement met, though, the organizational year in 1905, was not open to women. It was only open to men. And so the question is, where were the women while the men were meeting? Because very often in the historical writings about the founding of this movement, Mary Talbert is mentioned as a founder of the Niagara movement. And I said, that is questionable, again, because women were not invited to join in 1905, even though the group met at Mary Talbert's home. The women, including Mary Talbert, were having their own meeting. The Phyllis Wheatley Club and other clubs that were formulated as part of the National Association of Women's Clubs began to organize in statewide or regional groups. And in 1905, the West New York Federated Women's Clubs, a regional group, met in Buffalo. Mrs. Booker T. Washington was in attendance at that meeting, as was Mrs. Hester Jerome Jeffrey, who attended the first meeting of the Phyllis Wheatley Club and was a national organizer for the NACW. So the women were engaged at the same time that the Niagara movement was meeting. The women were engaged in their own activities. Again, moving forward the mission of the organization of the NACW and the Phyllis Wheatley Club. And also, by this time, in 1905, the Phyllis Wheatley Club had actually opened up their settlement home. And they were introducing their sisters from throughout Western New York and other clubs to the settlement home that they had on Potter Street. Potter Street, it now is Nash Street, where the Nash home is located. And again, the Nash home was the residence of the pastor of the Michigan Street Baptist Church, Reverend J. Edward Nash. That home offered already at this point in 1905 classes for sewing classes for young ladies. As you can see, even though they had a small group of young ladies at that point, they were active, and of course they had plans to grow. Mrs. Susan Evans, who was the first president of the Phyllis Wheatley Club, was a social worker, and she was charged with the development of the settlement home. She also was a officer of the National Association of Colored Women's Clubs, having been elected at the 1901 convention as one of the corresponding secretaries for the organization. You've seen Mary B. Talbert throughout this presentation because she's a significant leader in the women's club movement. Mrs. Talbert was born in Oberlin, Ohio. She was a graduate of Oberlin University, or Oberlin College at the time. And she graduated, she was 19 years old. She was an educator who went to teach in schools in Arkansas, and very shortly after became the vice principal of a high school in Arkansas, the first African-American woman to hold that role. She married Mr. William H. Talbert in 1891, moved to Buffalo, became a member of the Michigan Street Baptist Church, and as I said, one of the founding members of the Phyllis Wheatley Club. And there's much, much more to be said about Mrs. Talbert. And much is being written about her and about her life. But suffice it to say that this is a woman who had major leadership roles in so many of the issues and so many of the activist areas that African Americans were involved in during the period of time that she lived. Unfortunately, she died at the age of 57 in 1923, and much of the writings and the papers that she done are not available. They weren't preserved. And I found this photo in another 1900 newspaper, and it was quite intriguing to me. Certainly, again, organizations like the Phyllis Wheatley Club were very focused on young people and the education of young people, and more than likely would have been involved in this group of young women called the Oreo Circlet of Buffalo. Just a gorgeous, gorgeous picture, but unfortunately not anything else about this group. I believe the young women were named. None of the names were particularly known to me, but I hold out that as I do research that at some point I'm going to find out more information about them. But again, an example of the fact that African Americans were at the turn of the century in 1900 in Buffalo and Western New York and elsewhere and earlier, certainly focused on ways in which they could uplift themselves and reach out and help each other. Finally, the Phyllis Wheatley Club survived or thrived and contributed to this community for nearly 100 years. I have a photo of this young woman here, Mrs. Mary Crosby Chappelle, who was a member of the organization. Mrs. Chappelle died in 2006, and she was 100 years old at the time of her death. She was an educator. She was a journalist. She was a civil rights activist. She was a powerhouse in this community and a woman who I think exemplified for me, certainly, what the Phyllis Wheatley Club women did in persisting and working through struggles in order to improve and assist members of this community. When in 1999, I began to learn about the Phyllis Wheatley Club and about the women in the Phyllis Wheatley Club, trying to find out as much as I could about women, individual women who are part of the organization. And that helped me to develop, along with my colleague, an organization, started out as a project of the Women's Pavilion, but an organization called the Anne Crown Queens Institute. And the Institute's goal is to collect, to research, collect, preserve, and share the biographical histories of African-American women and as well as African-American men in this community, because like the Phyllis Wheatley Club and its activities, so much of that information is not well known, so much of it has not been documented and preserved, and so much of it is educational and inspirational information that young people should know and young people should learn about. There are many people in this community who have contributed in ways unknown, in ways large and small, in ways that are all important. And so when we talk to people about what the Uncrowned Queens is about and who it is we're trying to document, these are some of the ways of some of the characteristics or descriptors of Uncrowned Queens and who they are and why they are important and why we work to preserve their histories and to make them accessible on a web page that we call Uncrowned Community Builders. The Builders webpage is one that has taken the biographies, the histories of the queens, and combined them with histories of uncrowned kings. And so together, those individuals now are part of the project of the Uncrowned Queens Institute called the Uncrowned Community Builders. I have enjoyed sharing this information today about the Phyllis Wheatley Club, about their activities during the Pan American Exposition and throughout their first decade, about the ways in which this organization persisted throughout almost a century in this community, and hopefully to share this information with people who weren't aware of this dynamic organization that holds a place in history, in the history of Buffalo, that is significant and that should be known broadly by the community. So thank you for being part of this today. I hope that you will feel free to contact me if you like at bnevergold@gmail.com. I'd love to continue the conversation on James Parker and possibly on James Ross as well. Again, individuals whose history is intricately entwined with Buffalo's history. Just to leave one last thought, say that one of the goals of the Uncrowned Queens Institute is to have the community.
Welcome back. And that was a discussion on the history of the Phyllis Wheatley Club in Buffalo, New York, and also focusing heavily on the lifetimes and contributions of Mary Burnett Talbert, a pioneering African-American club woman who was involved in a number of struggles, and protests, and other efforts in support of the African-American struggle for freedom, justice, and equality during the late 19th, as well as the first two decades of the 20th century. And that's going to conclude the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast for Sunday, March 20th, 2022. We've been broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to our program. If you'd like to have access to this program, just go to our website at the Pan-African Radio Network, and that's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. And also, if you'd like to read the Pan-African Newswire, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And of course, the Pan-African Journal, a worldwide radio broadcast, is of course available at our website, and we of course very much interested in maintaining contact and keeping this program going. We're going to go back and close out with the music of Willie McThornton, better known as Big Mama Thornton. And this is from a 1968 release, a compilation of tunes called Ball and Chain. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful week.
gave me a $20 bill.
Start pouring out the bad liquor, and we're running down the street. began to howl. And you, I said, you better watch out, all you girls. Big Mama Red Rooster, he's now on the prowl. Because he keeps all the hens. Whoa! Keep them fighting among themselves. themselves.